Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by two members of the staff of Creighton's Center for Henry James Studies, Greg Zacharias, professor of English at Creighton, founder and director of the Center for Henry James Studies, and lead editor of The Complete Letters of Henry James, and Katie Summer, former graduate fellow at the Center for Henry James Studies, and currently the associate editor of The Complete Letters of Henry James. Dr. Zacharias will speak on the topic Henry James and the Great War. Ms. Summer will then speak on Henry James and Soldiers During World War I, Four Letters. This program, part of the World War I lecture series presented by the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library at Creighton, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, November 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speakers is Christine Carmichael, Web Services and Business Reference Librarian at the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library.
Today, we're going to hear from a couple of people from the Henry James Study Center. Dr. Greg Zacharias, here in the front, is a professor of English and director for the Center for Henry James Studies at Creighton University, as well as executive director of the Henry James Society. Greg is project director and co-general editor of the Complete Letters of Henry James, which is one of the largest literary letters projects in U.S. history. In addition to the 9 volumes published to date of the Letters Project, Greg has published or edited 3 other books in Henry James Studies. He has also published nearly 40 articles and book chapters on James and Mark Twain, and began teaching at Creighton in 1991, offering a range of courses at all levels. His colleague, Katie Summer, was a graduate fellow at the Center for Henry James Studies from 2001 to 2003. After several years in commercial publishing, she came back to work at the James Center in 2007 and is currently the associate editor of the Complete Letters of Henry James. So this afternoon, to start off, I'd like to ask Dr. Zacharias to come up. And as he's speaking and as Katie is speaking, we have an opportunity for you to take a look at some of the letters that were written both to and from Henry during his time.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks everyone for coming this afternoon. Henry James published some 24 novels, more than 100 short stories, several plays, and 1,000 pages of literary criticism and travel writing. But he wrote no fiction about World War I. And while there's relatively little scholarship on James and the Great War, you'll hear some of the best later from Katie Summer. This is not to say that war was not important to James. In fact, it was formative. Although neither James nor his older brother, the pioneering psychologist and philosopher William James, served in the Union Army during the Civil War, their younger brothers both did. One was severely wounded. Many of James's Newport and Cambridge friends and acquaintances, as well as several relatives, perished in the war. Like nearly everyone from their generation, the Civil War was a part of Henry James's identity. His long career as a professional writer began right after the conclusion of that war. When Britain entered the Great European War some 50 years later, Henry James was 71 years old. Since the end of the Civil War, James had written about war in letters, but never more than in passing. Occasionally, he had been interested enough in British military policy and practices to publish essays about British military ventures. But this war in 1914 was different from the others by orders of magnitude. The war engaged him. It preoccupied him. It depressed him. It consumed him. It also enabled him, in his old age, to find his vocation. By August 1914, with the conflicts of the recent past increasing in intensity, wider war was all but inevitable. James spoke for a generation when he wrote to his longtime friend Rhoda Broughton, "Black and hideous to me is the tragedy that gathers, and I'm sick beyond cure to have lived on to see it. You and I, the ornaments of our generation, should have been spared this wreck of our belief that through the long years we had seen civilization grow and the worst become impossible. The tide that bore us along was then all the while moving to this as its grand Niagara. Yet what a blessing, we didn't know it. It seems to me to undo everything, everything that was ours, in the most horrible retroactive way. But I avert my face from the monstrous scene. The fields of France and Belgium are being, or about to be, given up to unthinkable massacre and misery. That massacre and misery gripped James's consciousness and never let go. He died before the war ended. But by late September 1914, James's resignation in the face of the overwhelming violence and consequences of the war had shifted to something else. He had averted his face to the war, but now he faced it directly. He wrote to Lila Cabot Perry, whom he had known for nearly a lifetime. "We eat and drink and talk and walk and think. We sleep and wake and live and breathe only the war. And it is a bitter regimen enough, and as such, frankly, I hoped I shouldn't live on, disillusioned and horror-ridden to see the like of. What it above all means and has meant for me all this summer is that, looking almost straight over hence from the edge of the channel toward the horizon rim, just beyond the curve of which the infamous violation of Belgium has all these weeks kept up, I haven't had to face the shame of our not having drawn the sword for the massacred and tortured Flemings, and not having left our inestimable France, after vows exchanged, to shift for herself. England all but groveled in the dust to the Kaiser for peace up to the very latest hour. But when his last reply was simply to let loose his hordes on Belgium in silence, with no account of the act to this country or to France beyond the most fatuously arrogant, "because I choose to, damn you," in all recorded history, there began for us here a process of pulling ourselves together, of which the end is so far from being yet that I feel it only as the most rudimentary beginning. Like all England, where James had lived since 1876, he too began to pull himself together. James traced at least three courses by which he sought to contribute to the pulling together effort. One path was wholly personal, his effort to secure British citizenship, which he received in 1915, some 7 months before his death. The second path to contributing to the effort was more public, though it too yielded public profit, his work with the American Volunteer Motor Ambulance Corps, acronym AVMAC, and also his publication of propaganda pieces in the United States and in Britain that aimed to inspire Americans to join the war effort. The third path was chiefly personal, though it certainly yielded public good, his efforts to comfort wounded soldiers. Not only did James feel the horror and the harm of the war during its opening year, as he wrote in the passages I quoted a few minutes ago, but as an American citizen, and thus a legally designated friendly alien, James was obliged to report his comings to and going from his home in Rye on the English Channel, where he had been a resident since June 1898. He was obliged, that is, to put himself, as he wrote, under the observation of the police. He was also obligated to have a special government certificate of transport, a kind of internal passport. Not only was that obligation tedious, it was onerous and humiliating. It might have been the straw that broke his loyalty to the United States. But before he was required to assume that straw, he suffered frustration with the neutrality of the United States in the face of massive European devastation and death. This, too, pressed him to seek British citizenship. James's description of the U.S. president as the louche and sinister figure of Mr. Woodrow Wilson, who seems to be aware of nothing, captures James's frustration and increasingly acerbic attitude toward the American government. At the same time, James's friend, British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith, sponsored James's application to become a British subject. James wrote that he sought British citizenship because he, in his words, wished to testify at this crisis to the force of my attachment and devotion to England and the cause for which she is fighting. On July 26, 1915, James's application for naturalization having been approved, he took the oath of citizenship and declared imperially, "Civis Britannicus sum," I am a British citizen. But frustration with the U.S. government and later the assumption of British citizenship didn't mean that James forgot his American heritage and the importance of encouraging the United States to enter the war. When Richard Norton, the son of James's longtime friend Charles Elliot Norton, began in September 1914 to organize a motorized ambulance corps to serve at the front, for no nation had prepared either for the carnage or for caring for the casualties of the war, James agreed to join the project as its honorary chairman. As a part of that chairmanship, James wrote the American Volunteer Ambulance Corps in France, which he published in London. He published the same essay in the New York World as Famous Novelist Describes Deeds of U.S. Motor Corps. The essay is distinguished by the detail with which James describes the new operation of transporting the wounded and sick from the battlefront to hospitals by automobile rather than by train, and also for articulating the cost of this work, which he stated was $1.75 per day per driver for food and lodging if the contributor of the car or the driver couldn't pick up that expense, and also for naming the size of the staff, which was 34. But the essay is distinguished most by the humanity with which James characterizes this new operation, run by volunteers mostly from the United States. Here's a representative passage. "I find a positive added beauty in the fact that the unpaid chauffeur, the wise amateur driver and ready lifter, helper, healer, and so far as may be, consoler, is apt to be a university man and acquainted with other pursuits. One gets the sense that the labor, with its multiplied incidents and opportunities, is just unlimitedly inspiring to the keen spirit or the sympathetic soul, the recruit with energies and resources on hand that plead with him for the beauty of the vivid and palpable social result." Not only was AVMAC necessary, for James it was an expression of deep humanity, charity, and civilized conduct. James's so-called first interview with a byline from Preston Lockwood and a rewrite from Henry James himself was published in the New York Times on March 21, 1915. The interview of the famous novelist served mainly to promote AVMAC. It concludes with an invitation for readers to contribute to the ambulance corps. James also published in the New York Times that same year an In Memoriam piece for Alan D. Loney, who supported AVMAC and died in the sinking of the British passenger ship Lusitania by German U-boat torpedoes. Of James's several other essays that aimed to engage the American public in the war, two of the most moving to me are Refugees in England and The Long Wards. Refugees in England was published in the New York Times October 17, 1915. James offers it to, in his words, generous American communities from a neighbor and an observer deeply affected by the most tragic exhibition of national and civic prosperity and felicity suddenly subjected to bewildering outrage that it would have been possible to conceive. The overall aim of the powerful piece was to demonstrate and even to reinforce, from James, possibilities of sympathy and reaches of beneficence very much as the stricken and suffering themselves live into their dreadful history and explore and reveal its extent. "Those suffering people," James went on, "are the Belgians driven hither from their country by a violence of unprovoked invasion and ravage more appalling than has ever before overtaken a peaceful and industrious people." The crucial passage James constructed to show the passivity and innocence and also helplessness of the Belgian people who are victims of the German invasion and atrocities against civilians frames a mother and her child who seek shelter and protection. The following is from the concluding passages of that essay. "It was in September, in a tiny Sussex town which I had not quitted since the outbreak of the war, and here the advent of our first handful of fugitives had just been announced. We had waited all day for the moment at which we could attest to our hospitality. It came at last, but late in the evening. Up the precipitous little street that led from the railroad station, over the old grass-grown cobbles where vehicles rarely pass, came the panting procession of the homeless, and their comforting, their almost clinging entertainers, who seemed to hurry them on as a sort of overflow of expression or fever of charity. It was swift and eager in the autumn darkness and under the flare of a single lamp, with no vociferation and, but for a woman's voice, scarce a sound, save the shuffle of mounting feet and the thick-drawn breath of emotion. The note I accept, however, was that of a young mother carrying her small child and surrounded by those who bore her on and on, almost lifting her as they went together. The resonance through our immemorial old street of her sobbing and her sobbing cry was the voice itself of history. It brought home to me more things than I then could quite take measure of, and these just because it expressed for her not direct anguish, but the incredibility, as who should say, of assured protection. James published The Long Wards as part of Edith Wharton's collection of war essays, The Book of the Homeless. Not only did The Long Wards seek to engage its readers, especially American ones, in the war effort by implying their role in serving its victims, just as refugees in England did, but The Long Wards offered another class of war victims, sick and wounded soldiers. Serving those soldiers invoked for James the wounded of an earlier war, as he said, out of the distant past, that is, the Civil War. Those soldiers of the distant past, including two of his brothers and many of his friends and acquaintances, defined for James the thickest mantle of our heroic history, just as the cries of the Belgian mother and child for James voiced history itself. But in relation to the death and destruction the world was witnessing in 1915, James wrote that the whole previous illustration of history turns pale. James found it remarkable that the sick and wounded, who had only recently been prepared, as he wrote, to advance and explode and destroy, are now, like the refugees in his town, reduced to helplessness in the innumerable instances now surrounding us, and they live in communities of patience and placidity. Those communities called to James, just as James hoped that they should call to his readers, who would respond as James responded, with interest, care, kindness, and hospitality. Such a response of assured protection, James implies, is the bedrock of the best life has to offer. Thus he wrote, "If this abundance of appreciation from the wounded, all slighted and unencouraged, can still comfort us who tend them, what wouldn't it do for us tended and fostered and cultivated? That is my moral, for I believe in culture, strictly speaking now of the honest and of our own congruous kind." I think it would be easy to read James's high praise for the moral value to be found in and taken from serving the wounded, the dying, the sick, as sentimental, and even the exiled, too, as sentimental propaganda for seducing Americans to join the Allies in their war effort. But that reading would miss the fundamental personal importance James himself found in serving those soldiers, so much as Walt Whitman had done in that earlier war. To Edith Wharton, James described the inspiration he drew from the patience and fortitude of the wounded, not only when he served in hospital, but in his everyday contacts with soldiers whenever and wherever he met them. And he wrote to Wharton, "The thing that most assuages me from the horror of the war continues to be dealing with the wounded in such scant measure as I may. Such, for example, is my having turned into Victoria Station yesterday afternoon to buy an evening paper, and there have been so struck with the bad lameness of a poor hobbling khaki convalescent that I inquired of him to such sympathetic effect that, by what I can make out, I must have committed myself to the support of him for the remainder of his days. A trifle on account of having sealed the compact on the spot. Most telling, though, is that after 71 years, James does not locate his life's calling only in 2 Nobel Prize nominations, a full career as a professional writer, some 24 novels, 100 stories, plays, and scores of travel essays and critical pieces. He locates it only in his care for wounded soldiers, many of whom could speak only French, and he was a fluent French speaker. He could help them in that way. And therefore, they required special attention in England. They alone enabled James to declare, "I almost discovered my vocation in life to be the beguiling and drawing out of the suffering soldier." Thank you.
Greg, for a fabulous paper, and thanks, Deb, and thanks, Chris, for setting this up. So among the papers that the James family loaned to us at the Center for Henry James Studies are 4 letters written not by Henry James, but by soldiers to James during the first months of World War I. And I believe they're circulating here, and if you don't see them, I'll have images later. There are many interesting things about these letters. First, the men who wrote them were ordinary English soldiers. One was a carpenter by trade. Another was a chauffeur. They were sappers and privates, and it's apparent from the way that they wrote that some have had little formal education. The second is that James kept them, when the amount of letters that he kept through his entire life is minuscule compared to the amount he received and wrote. And at this time of his life, he was in the habit of destroying most of the correspondence he received. But perhaps the most notable thing about these letters is that they provide a first-hand account of James's activity with and feelings toward active duty soldiers during the Great War. James was an elderly man at the outbreak, but these letters, when read with others, clearly show how he went to great physical, financial, and emotional lengths to fully participate in World War I, and more specifically, to help soldiers who were convalescing in London. It's also noteworthy that World War I, such a seminal event in modern history, occupies a relatively small space in James' studies, especially since we know how greatly it affected the last months of his life. Though his concern for soldiers as a group is fairly well known, it's little has been written about James's involvement with them individually. And yet, involved he is. In a survey of his correspondence and date books, I've identified 19 visits to 4 different hospitals during the 4 months between December 1914 and March 1915, which averages out to about once every 6 days. James also sends care packages to soldiers on the front, and in these he included chocolate, socks, a comb, cigarettes, among other little luxuries which the men appreciated. "I received your packet of handkerchiefs," writes one of the soldiers, a driver named Bassett. "When I read your kind letter, it gave me great pleasure to know you received and liked my short letter of thanks." We don't have James's letter to Bassett, but Bassett and James's back and forth was likely similar to that of James and his valet, Burgess Noakes, who also fought in World War I. James fills his letters to Private Noakes with gentle sympathy and encouragement, praising him as one of the best and most willing and intelligent soldiers to come out of England. James cheers him on in the most meaningful ways he can. "I take the greatest pleasure in how good a letter you write," says James, in what must be one of the highest forms of praise from the author. And then he follows it up with, "If it socks you will throughout most want, I'll keep you supplied." William Kidd's letter also thanks James for his kindness and hospitality while Kidd was on leave in London. Now, some maintain that James's wartime efforts were either a way for him to rewrite his Civil War experience or a method in which he kept himself relevant in the early 20th century. But the constant devotion and activity are much more genuine expression of his kindness, empathy, and concern for the soldiers he deeply respects and comes to care for. Now, as I said before, there are four letters from the soldiers to Henry James that we have here at Creighton, and all four are fascinating, meaningful, and poignant in their own ways. However, although I'll read from all four, I've chosen to focus mostly on two. Information about these and the two other two letters can be found online at the Center for Henry James Studies Finding Aid. Sapper Thomas James Williams was an early enlister who, before the war, lived in a working-class suburb of London, and I'll read his letter here in its entirety. Feb 16, 1915, 113A, Tolworth Park Road, Surbiton. Henry James esque, it begins. Dear sir, I am writing to thank you once again for what you have caused to be done to my mouth. I have got my teeth in today, and am thankful to say I feel very little ill convenience. My next appointment with Messer Field is fixed Thursday, Feb 18 at 11 a.m., again thanking you for your great help. I beg to remain your obedient servant, Sapper Thomas James Williams. Williams became a sapper for the Royal Engineers when he enlisted on 14 October 1914. He was a carpenter and an ex-runner from Surbiton, Surrey, and he had three children and a wife. James writes about Williams quite a bit during the early months of 1915. Anyone familiar with James's datebooks and correspondence during this time will no doubt recognize Williams as a somewhat major character in James's life in January and February. During these 2 months, James records a remarkable 7 meetings with Williams in his datebook, more than any other person at this time. And we know from his other correspondence that James and Williams meet at least 2 other times. James lauds Williams in his letters, as he does almost all the soldiers he meets, and he sets his own war effort alongside the soldiers. In a letter to Anna Lodge, for instance, James humbly describes his service as small and futile, though as a whole it reflects a real degree of his attachment to England's cause. Today, for instance, he writes to Lodge, I have been taking to my dentist, a convalesced soldier, a sapper of the RE, whom I fished out of a hospital, and this is Thomas Williams. So let's turn then to how James is helping Williams. From James's letters to others, from his datebooks, and from Williams' reply, we know that James has arranged dental care for Williams through his own dentist, George Field. Dental work for a soldier. It might seem odd to us now that James spearheaded this, but the need for basic dental care was disconcertingly common among British soldiers during World War I. Dental care, or lack thereof, was a real problem that affected any person's lifespan in the early 20th century. Common abscesses could easily become lethal if not treated properly, and they were very often not treated properly, if at all, especially on the war front. Lieutenant Colonel J.G. McNeice of the Royal Army Medical Corps wrote that by far the two biggest health concerns for soldiers during the early 20th century were syphilis and cavities. Indeed, he claimed that for England to have an efficient army, these would have to be stridently addressed. And beginning an enlistment period with a clean bill of dental health improved the quality of life of a soldier during the duration of his service. Although Williams' enlistment medical check was normal, that doesn't mean he couldn't have had what we would now think of as major dental problems. The Journal of the Royal Army Medical Corps outlines the process by which a doctor evaluates an enlistee's teeth. The man can have up to 10 dead or decaying teeth before he is rejected for service. The standard became more loose as World War I progressed and the need for soldiers became more pressing. McNeice provides an example for military dentists on how to fill out the dental portion of a soldier's enlistment medical check, and note that he signals 14 dead or decaying teeth, which is a strong indication that such a mouth is somewhat normal. Even with such lax, as we would say today, dental health guidelines, an estimated 27% of men were rejected from military duty on grounds of tooth problems, and 20% of men in military hospitals were there due to some form of dental infection. The problem was there from the moment the war was declared. More than 70% of British Army recruits needed dental care at the beginning of the war, and the situation didn't improve. In fact, a special fleet of military motor ambulances was established to attend solely to dental problems on the front. So we can loosely reconstruct the timeline of Williams' dental care as arranged by Henry James. James never says when he first met Williams, but after a survey of his letters and datebooks, I believe it's likely in January 1915 during a visit to St. Bart's Hospital in London. According to James's datebook, on 25 January 1915, James met Williams in the afternoon to discuss the state of Williams' teeth. On the same day, James reminded himself that he wrote to Dr. Field about it. James again wrote to Williams about dentist on 1 February to discuss details about Williams' first consultation at Dr. Field's, which occurred on 4 February. A week and a half later, Williams began a series of appointments at Dr. Field's. Williams saw the dentist on the 15th, the 18th, and the 19th of February. And it's during this series of appointments that Williams wrote to James. James saw Williams at least twice more in the next week. It's remarkable, really, that he saw Sapper Williams individually three times in 7 days. And when once when he accompanied Williams to Dr. Field's on 19 February, and again when he hosted a lunch for Williams on February 22nd. So the exact nature of Williams' dental problems is unknown. Clues from Williams' letter, such as when he writes, "I have got my teeth in today," and the fact that there were 3 days of scheduled appointments in quick succession makes it likely that he needed some sort of prosthetic teeth and perhaps extractions to go with it. James was quite familiar with such work. Almost exactly a year earlier, Dr. Field had extracted most of James's teeth and also fitted him up with new dentures, a process that James called momentous and one that also consumes his datebook and correspondence. James wrote to Edith Wharton that from the beginning it made a marked difference in the way he felt. When he saw an opportunity to provide a similar relief to someone he admired as much as a convalescing soldier, like Williams, he jumped at the chance and organized it. It's very unlikely that Williams paid for this care himself, considering how effusively he thanks James in his letter and how expensive it would have been for a working-class carpenter-turned-soldier with a family to support. It is possible that James sponsored it, as he wrote to Alice James that he had been having it done up for him, indicating financial responsibility, and that it was done at very reduced military rates. The Journal of the Royal Army Medical Corps suggests that the military rate during the beginning of World War I was around £3, or about half of what it would cost for a civilian, very reduced indeed. And I just did the conversion before I came over, and in today's money, it would be about $1,200. That's the half. All of this is to say that dental work during this time was a pretty big deal in terms of time, money, opportunities, and physical health. For a soldier like Williams, to have it coordinated by somebody like Henry James would have been an even bigger deal. Now, why do soldiers like James get singled out for particular attention when James visits hospitals for convalescing men? Most likely it is because he feels some sort of connection with them. For Williams, the connection was that James knew he could help improve the state of Williams' health. For another soldier I'm discussing today, James also provides help, but this time it's mental and emotional. Archibald C. Claringbold was born in 1889 in Bury St. Edmunds. He was the son of John and Anna Claringbold. Before he enlisted, he was a chauffeur. During the time he knew James, he was a private in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. And here I'll read a few representative passages from his letter. "To Henry James Esk, you will see that I have taken up my next quarters, having arrived here late at night on Monday last. Regarding myself, I am so glad to say I am mastering this wretched nervous trouble. No doubt the change of air and surroundings will have the effect of restoring me completely to health. My work here is of a very varied and interesting nature, and I feel more fit now to deal with it. I must conclude, sir, with my most sincere hope that your complaint is still within check." Now, wretched nervous trouble. Claringbold, like many other soldiers during World War I, was suffering from some sort of psychological trauma, no doubt brought on by the terrors of war. Shell shock was a term that was developed during World War I, and according to the medical entity that defined the syndrome, it encompassed all those mental effects of war experience which are sufficient to incapacitate a man from the performance of his military duties. Although mental health was just beginning to be studied in a clinical sense in the early 20th century, a modern and humane approach to treating mental illness was unfortunately yet to come. Yet many doctors recognized that World War I soldiers were a special case due to the intense nature of the war's combat. At the end of the war, the British military community developed several approaches to treating patients with shell shock. In its opinion, the most crucial was using discourse as a form of therapy. The soldier might have private interviews with his medical officer, and the history of the trouble can be unraveled in conversation, it advised. It is only in this way that any scientific insight into a case of mental disorder can be obtained. It's important to note that the emphasis is theirs. In a very real way, James, through his visiting and his teeing, his small talk and his socializing, is taking part in the psychological treatment of soldiers like Archibald Claringbold with shell shock. He helps them talk it out, which was the exact treatment the medical community advocated. Let's think again about how the medical community defines shell shock. Mental effects of war, psychological strain, incapacitating a man from the performance of his job, these were heartbreakingly familiar to James. It has often been noted that the last big depressive phase in James's life ended only a few months before war broke out, and I also argue that the war caused another brief depressive phase lasting from August until November 1914. During that time, James's datebook is literally blank of any social engagements. It shows us that for James, something is very different, and that something has led to a deep, painful void. Those dark days, as he mournfully describes them in a letter to Constance Gardner. It is a very emotional response, and he uses the words that conjure up disturbing and psychologically terrible images to describe the war during those months. Monsters and nightmares are two adjectives he uses constantly in these letters. He makes frequent references to the devil, hell, horror, terror, menace, and murder in almost every single letter during this time. It's doubtful that, when chatting with Claringbold, James was as candid about his own mental health as he was with, say, his brother William, but it's not hard to imagine James patting Claringbold's hand comfortingly and telling him, "I understand, I've been through this too." It was likely something of these two periods of depression that Claringbold was referring to when he wrote to your complaint, so much like his own wretched nervous trouble. On the 1st of May, 1917, Sapper Thomas Williams, fighting in one of the battles of Arras in the north of France, was killed by a gunshot wound to the back. He's buried at Nuisan Cemetery near Calais, along with 3,200 other British soldiers. Now, obviously, James would never know of Williams' death since he had died the year before, but what is likely is that James would have mourned Williams the same way he mourned Rupert Brooke, Wilfred Sheridan, and the other soldiers he cared for, with beauty, kindness, and compassion, empathy, and real emotion. Toward the end of 1915, James's visits to convalescing soldiers became more infrequent due to his physical health and old age. But these were replaced by a snowballing amount of beautiful and sad letters of condolence written to wives and mothers who had lost their husbands and sons during the war. They, like the letters from the soldiers themselves, are tributes that reflect his relationships with these men that continued until the last days of his life. Thank you.
Greg, you mentioned kind of, I think, two competing forms of history in your introductory talk. One about, James refers to it as a Niagara, but then also very clearly, deeply, personally embodied. I wondered if you might talk a bit more about those competing forms of history for James in this period.
Well, I think the Niagara part was the flow of history and the force of history that was pushing him and everyone else to some place they didn't know where they would be. And at this time, as England was about to declare war and enter the war, I guess it was over the falls and down at the bottom. That's where that Grand Niagara would take them. And then the second part, I think, was how he responded to it. Right, that would, in a sense, be his internal response to those impressions, that understanding of history, and I think that's how he's really responding to the refugees and to the soldiers, at least as he represents them. So I think in some ways, just this, you know, we're following the events of this past week around the world, you know, we also feel kind of carried away by it. It's something that's completely out of our control and is sweeping us along, and we hope it's not going to sweep us over the falls without a barrel. Even maybe if we can get in a barrel, that would be a different story. But then I think we each individually have to respond in our own way, and as we talk with others about what's happening, and we're moved by the events, but I think then we understand history in our own ways, and I think that was James's sense of history.
I'm interested by the kind of geographical nature of his use of the metaphor Niagara or waterfall idea. That is that something, in some ways I've known Henry James writing for a long time, but I'm not in any way a practicing expert on the subject. But at the same time, I'm wondering if you could tell us if images or metaphors like Niagara are characteristic of his Henry James's writing in to other people, in his actual creative writing. Do you think that that use of Niagara is something that was very natural and frequent for him, or something that was somewhat unique to these circumstances?
A long time ago, in the days when scholars combed through the work of poets and novelists to count images, Tom, maybe you remember these days. Robert Gale combed through James's novels, and he counted James's images. And the second most frequent image in James's novels were water images. And this seemed important to me at one time. I was doing some other work with James's novels and James's habits of expression, and this is what you're asking about, James's habits of expression. And I trusted Bob Gale's count that water images were important, and I looked to find when did those water images tend to appear. And for James, and I think he was not really in control of this, I think it's just how his imagination worked, that water images tend to appear in novels at times of importance in plot development, right? And they tend to carry a lot, in a sense, a lot of moral weight. They flag morally important moments in novels. So I think when James is thinking about expressing his feelings, accounting his personal history, and wants to express something that's important and morally important, he would tend to go to something that has to do with water. But the expression about Niagara Falls, I can't remember off the top of my head seeing it before. It might occur, and there might be other images of waterfalls and so on, but I can't think of any right now.
Okay. If I was listening correctly at the beginning, Greg, you mentioned that the war doesn't figure predominantly into James's fiction, but does obviously in these letters and in the essays. Can you speculate a little bit about why that might be?
He pretty much finished writing novels by this time. So he was kind of old. I mean, you know, he was old, and that part of his life was really over. He's shortly before the war, he was writing his kind of his autobiographies and unfinished novels, things like this. Why the First World War didn't kind of play into this? I think it probably happened too late in his life. The Civil War plays a part in some early stories, but it, in a sense, only as a plot device. I think for what he did as a writer, really had to do with interpersonal relations. I think overall, inter-character relations. He could do what he needed to do without locating the action in war.
Well, your papers are a contribution or illustrations of how the editions of the letter bring new knowledge to the scholarship. So could you talk a little bit more about that, how the editions of the letters can cast new light on James's facts on his life or scholarship in general?
Do you want to go?
Sure.
You know, the thing that I love most about working on the letters is that, you know, he's a fabulous writer, and there's so much scholarship to be done on James and his writings. But in his letters, you get to know the man. And that's, you know, not the most academic answer, but it's a very emotional part of working in James' studies, is having this emotional connection to him. So when you see him, you know, asking these soldiers, can I give you socks? Can I give you this ointment? Let me send you a chocolate bar. It rounds out and, you know, it gives us another nuance of his personality. And that's what I think these, you know, these letters combined with the letters that James wrote to soldiers and others during this time, that's what, you know, contributes to the James letters as a whole. And we have other letters that he mentions Sapper Williams and he mentions the other soldiers. And so the letters that we have from the soldiers just make it all complete at this time in his life, when there really isn't a whole lot of literature that he wrote to flesh out this, you know, the last whatever 18 months of his existence.
You know, the sort of the mainstream idea, I think, that all of us had until maybe 15 years ago, and a lot of people still have about James, is that he was this this man 100% dedicated to fiction, to writing fiction. That's all he wanted to do. He didn't want to deal with people. He never wanted to have deep relationships. He never had love interests, et cetera, et cetera, because he was so linked to the fiction. And this is a really an idea that was developed by the great James scholar of the last century, Leon Edel, in Edel's a magisterial biography of James. And in order to make the biography, Edel had to read a lot of James's letters. He read thousands and thousands of James's letters. But he excerpted from the body of letters passages that would fit his portrait of James as the master. In the late 80s, Edel was old, and the person in the James family who had control of the letters died. The letter archive, in a sense, was open. There was a new executor to the James family papers, and people who were interested started to read not only the letters that Edel had reported, but a lot of other letters. You know, thousands and thousands of other letters. And emerging from that reading, then the work that Katie and I and so many others are doing shows a different picture of James, a rounder picture of James, a very hardworking professional writer who strove to make the right social connections in order to get good jobs, get good writing jobs, a portrait of a person who was a very, very good friend, a person who was also a good neighbor in his town, right? And so I think now, let's say post-Edel, post-Henry James Master, this is the kind of the rounder, fuller picture of Henry James that the work we're doing is starting to show. And I think the letters Katie talked about and how she talked about them shows just one dimension of this person who was not disengaged from the world around him, but just the opposite. He was deeply, deeply engaged in the world around him. Chris is nodding her head, so that must mean we're done. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by two members of the staff of Creighton's Center for Henry James Studies, Greg Zacharias, professor of English at Creighton, founder and director of the Center for Henry James Studies, and lead editor of The Complete Letters of Henry James, and Katie Summer, former graduate fellow at the Center for Henry James Studies, and currently the associate editor of The Complete Letters of Henry James. Dr. Zacharias spoke on the topic Henry James and the Great War. Miss Summer then spoke on Henry James and soldiers during World War I, four letters. This program, part of the World War I lecture series presented by the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library at Creighton, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, November 16, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.